This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Antonio Banderas, stars in the new film Pain and Glory, written and directed by the master Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodóvar. Banderas won the Best Actor Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival for his performance in Pain and Glory. He plays a screenwriter and director who lives to make movies, but has stopped working because he's suffering with physical pain and pain of the soul. Almodóvar modeled the character on himself. Banderas and Almodóvar started making movies together in Spain in the 1980s, after the long repressive regime of General Francisco Franco had ended. The films were bold and transgressive for the time, with gay, trans, and straight characters, and sex and drugs. Banderas started acting in American films before he could even speak English. In 1992, he co-starred in the movie The Mambo Kings. The following year, he starred opposite Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. He went on to star in many films, including the El Mariachi trilogy, Spy Kids, and The Mask of Zorro. He voiced the character of Puss in Boots in the Shrek films and in Puss in Boots. In 2011, he reunited with Almodóvar to make The Skin I Live In. Antonio Banderas, welcome to Fresh Air. You're so good in this new film, in Almodóvar's new film. It's really a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Early in the film, there's a part where you, as in your role as a director who is afflicted with all kinds of symptoms, is recounting his symptoms. And I'm actually going to ask for your permission to read a voiceover that you do early in the movie. I can't play the voiceover because it's in Spanish. So right. I'm gonna read some of the English translation of it. This scene just really grabbed me. And we're hearing your voiceover in the role of the director that you play. And as you're describing the symptoms that afflict you, on screen what we're seeing is illustrations and animations of the human body, anatomical drawings. I'm going to read some of this voiceover.
Absolutely.
I got to know my body through pain and illness. I lived my first 30 years with relative abandon, but I soon discovered that my head and what was inside it, as well as being a source of pleasure and knowledge, also carried with it infinite possibilities of pain. I soon became acquainted with insomnia, chronic pharyngitis, otitis, reflux, ulcers, and intrinsic asthma. Nerves in general and the sciatic in particular, and all kinds of muscular pain, lumbar, dorsal, tendinitis in both knees and shoulders. Tinnitus, I have that too. Wheezes and whistles, I also suffer from those. My specialty is headaches and back pain. After the spinal fusion operation, which immobilized half my back, I discovered that my life would revolve around my spinal column. But not everything is so visible. I also suffer from more abstract hardships, pains of the soul, such as panic and anxiety, which add anguish and terror to my life. And naturally, I've dealt for years with depression. Yeah. That sets up the movie so well, like physical pain and pain of the soul. And I know Almodóvar suffers from a lot of physical pain. Yeah. Can we talk about that first? Did he talk to you about why he wrote those lines and the pain that the character he created that you play resonates for him?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, this is a man that actually suffered practically for everything that you just read, you know. I mean, each one of those physical problems. And so when he's trying just to put part of his life, you know, at front, on the screen, tell a story. He needs to just say all of these things, you know, as establishing a physical map of who he is, you know, in terms of pain. We actors use practically everything that happened in our life in order to create the characters that we create. I suffered a heart attack about 2.5 years ago. And that was an alert in my life. And when I say this, people may just think that I am crazy, but it's one of the best things that ever happened in my life because it just gave me a perspective of who I was, and it just make the important things being on the surface, and everything that was not important, that I thought it was important, but it was not important, just sunk. Now, by the time that I started working with Almodóvar in this movie, that was very close to this event, this cardiac event that I had, and Pedro said to me, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but since you have the heart attack, there is something different in you, and I don't want you to hide it. I don't want you to just go, because if you just show it, it's going to be very close to all of these pains that I describe in the movie, and I want you there in that universe that is absolutely new to me, and probably is going to be new as a you know, for the spectator, for the public, to see you in a completely different context.
Did he know that you had had a heart attack when he asked you to do the role?
Yes.
Your character is holding everything in. He's holding in his pain. He's holding in a lot of his emotions.
Yeah.
While also digging deep into memories of the past. And because of the pain, he's unable to make films, or at least he thinks he's unable to make films. Mm-hmm. So you have to communicate a lot just by the way you hold your body and your face and your eyes.
Correct.
And that's, yeah, it's a very, I would imagine that's a very hard thing to do. Within the movie, we eventually learn that your character, the director, has been writing a monologue, and he wants an actor friend of his to perform it. And this actor friend, they had a falling out, like, I don't know, 20 years ago or more, and they had a falling out while this actor was being directed by your character. And when they come together after your character asks him to perform the monologue, they're talking about, like, how to convey the drama and the pain that is going to be expressed. And I forget whether the director says to the actor or the actor says that another director had told him this, but it was basically, don't overdo it with the sadness. Hold back the tears. That's the best way of expressing it. Was that advice Almodóvar gave to you, or that another director had given to you?
Yeah, he calls that the humid emotion, wet
humid
emotions.
Okay, wet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And he said, he always said to me, you know, I don't want wet emotions. You know, actors, you guys love to cry because you think that it's a demonstration that you are real. And but that's another trick sometimes too. You know, there are. He said to me once that he knew an actress that she can cry from her right eye or from her left eye. So that's a trick. You can do that, and you can apply all the reality that you want to that, but it's not true. I prefer actors who actually hold back the tears, hold the emotions. You know, that they are more, less busy, more transparent, more economic. That's probably the word, you know, more economic in the emotions. And that's been a constant in Almodóvar, which is sometimes a contradiction because people think that Almodóvar is a little bit bigger than life, you know, in his expressions, in narrative, in many different colors, for example, in the framing and stuff like that. But then he is very measured with the actors. He liked the actors to be, you know, in a way more in the way that he dreamt movies, and it has to do with the movies that were done in the 40s and in the 50s.
So I just want to get back to the fact that you had a heart attack a couple of years before making okay. the movie. And you said a nurse in the hospital told you the heart not only pumps blood throughout your body, the heart is a warehouse for feelings, and that you should expect to be sad for a few weeks or for a few months following the heart attack and having stents put in. And I'm wondering if that happened, if you were sad, and if having been told in advance to expect being sad was helpful to you.
Yeah. I can tell you about mine, mm-hmm. because there are thousands of ways that you can have a heart attack. In my particular case, you know, yes, that woman that came to me was a nurse at the hospital, and she said that she was right on. I became not only very sad, but very sensitive to anything. I am not a crier. I was never a crier. I was, you know, a tough guy. And suddenly, I was watching movies and I was listening to music, and suddenly I got all teary. And I don't know. You feel very vulnerable, and you totally understand that there is only one thing that is absolutely perfect, which is death, and that is certain, and everything else is relative.
So when you started working in theater, and when you started working with Pedro Almodovar, it was in the decade after Spain's longtime dictator Francisco Franco had died. He ruled from 1939 to 1975. The Spanish Civil War was to stop fascist rule, but Spain got fascist rule for a long time. So when Franco died, and the restraints and the fear were removed, that's when the counterculture, the artistic counterculture, came alive in Spain, and you were a part of that, as was Almodovar. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to be making art during that period when, you know, fascism had ended and there was a new generation coming of age without fascism, who could express themselves and who could be transgressive in their art if they wanted to be.
Yeah, well, when Franco died, I was 15 years old. I was a kid, and I was living in Spain that basically more than repressive, under my perception at that time, as a child almost, is that we were in kind of anesthesia. That was the feeling, that nothing happened. Everything was fine, in a very kind of eerie way, you know, fine. This guy was there in power, and he was like your uncle, you know. He was always Franco. Yeah, this is what we have. And so when he died, I started growing into being a man, almost in a parallel way that my country was going from a dictatorship to a democracy. And at that time, you start discovering what the dictatorship was. Then you start seeing what freedom is all about, and then you start just looking back and say, oh my God, how could I have lived there without knowing that this thing exists? So it was a time for the whole entire Spanish people to discover a new world, to adapt, to, you know, prove ourselves that we can be a democratic country, that we can actually decide for our own future. And there was a group of people, among them Pedro Almodóvar and some musicians and fashion designers and photographers and people in the world of art of all kind, that decide to just break with the past and just create something new. So it was a time of a lot of color, a lot of hope and fun and no restrictions in every possible way, and about breaking a lot of you know, morality rules that were monolithic and very conservative and in our country. And it was a beautiful time.
Your father was a police officer. Had he been a police officer under Franco too?
Yeah, he was. He was. He was actually chief of police of Malaga, which is the place where I was born.
Was he afraid that your art and your behavior during the countercultural period in Spain would reflect badly on him and would make him look compromised?
I don't know, because my father, believe it or not, he was a big supporter of me. He helped me, actually. He helped me with funds when I didn't have one penny and I was living in Madrid and I didn't have work or anything. And then I started working in the National Theater, and somebody said to me, I didn't even know that. He said, you know that your father comes every night and he sits in the last seat of the orchestra to watch you performing every night? And I said, really? And he said, yeah, every night he comes here and he sees you, and then he goes away because he doesn't want you to see him.
Wow. Did you tell him that you knew?
No, I never did. Because if he didn't want, I didn't want to just disappoint him.
Is he still alive?
No, my father died in February 2008. Yeah.
So he never knew that you knew?
Yeah, never knew.
Huh. So you grew up in Spain. You started your acting career in Spain in theater and in film. Then you decided to move to America, I guess, to make movies here. Problem was, you didn't speak any English. And when I think about that, I just can't imagine. It's hard enough to go to any country where you don't speak the language, but to go to that country looking for a job acting in a language that you don't speak, I can't imagine what that must have been like for you. That took that took a lot of chutzpah is a word that comes to mind to do that.
Yeah, it was kind of an accident in a way, because we were nominated for an Academy Award at the time for best foreign film with the Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. That's the first time I went to Los Angeles. And then, there was a guy there. We visit a place called ICM. It's an agency for actors. And there was a person there that was literally taking coffees to the agent, who was not even an agent. And he said to me, do you mind if I represent you here in America? And as you know, this kind of thing that you say, yeah, sure, whatever. I didn't know. I said, yeah. So I went back to Spain after the ceremony and the whole thing. And this guy was actually very perseverant. And at some point he said to me, listen, they made me an agent already. And you should go to London to have an interview with a man called Arnie Glimcher. Now, Arnie Glimcher is the owner of a very strong, art gallery in New York. It's called Pace Gallery. But he's a producer, too, and he want to direct this movie called The Mambo Kings. And it's a movie based on a novel that won the Pulitzer Prize by Oscar Hijuelos. And he said, you go there and have dinner with this man because, he's interested in your performances with some of the Almodóvar movies, and he may have a character for you in that movie. And I said, okay, so he speaks Spanish. And he says, no, he doesn't speak Spanish, he speaks English. I said, so how are we going to do this interview? I said, well, you just manage. And I said, well, how am I going to manage? So they put me on a plane, and I ended up in London in a restaurant in front of this very elegant man, And I just kind of faked that I was shy, and I speak very little. And he just talked and talked, and I couldn't understand a word that he said. Really, I was just saying yeses and yeah and of course things like that, I think towards the end of the first dish he just realized that I couldn't speak a word of English, so because he started just laughing and the whole situation became very funny. But for whatever reason he said to me, okay, very slowly he explained to me that I should go to New York and do a screen test, learning my lines phonetically. And I said to him, yeah, I can do that. I can learn that as I learn a song from the Beatles. Yeah, I can do that. So that's how I got into American movies. I came here to New York and I did a screen test, several actually during a period of time of 3 or 4 days, and I learned my lines phonetically, and at the end they decided that they were going to take the risk of using me in the movie as an actor. So that was the beginning of my American career, and I thought it was going to be the exception of the rule, that I was going to go back to Spain and continue doing my movies in Spain, my activities there, normally. But then the movie came out and Jonathan Demme saw it and they called me again, and I did screen test with Tom Hanks for Philadelphia, and I did another movie, and then it was back and forth like this until I met Melanie Griffith, and that changed my life, because we fell in love and the rest is history, and I decided just to move to America.
Antonio Banderas, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Congratulations on Pain and Glory. Your performance is so good. Thank you for coming on our show.
My pleasure, really.
Antonio Banderas stars in the new Pedro Almodóvar movie, Pain and Glory. My next guest is Conan O'Brien. He's been up to some new things. He changed the format of his late-night TBS show and cut it back to half an hour. and he now has a popular podcast called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, featuring his conversations with comics, actors, and writers. Season 2 starts Monday. Conan O'Brien was a comedy writer, having worked on The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live when he first started hosting NBC's Late Night in the spot that had been David Letterman's. Conan was an unknown as a performer, and a lot of people thought he wouldn't make it. But now he's been hosting late-night shows longer than anyone else on the air, 26 years. His career has taken some surprising twists and turns, but he's never stopped being funny. Conan O'Brien, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been a long time, and it's a great pleasure to have you back. The podcast is called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. My guess is that you have friends, you just don't have time to actually talk with them.
That's very good. Yes, I have. I have friends. What's interesting is that the title of the podcast was, it's kind of a joke, but as Freud would tell you, there are no jokes. There is a grain of truth in it, which is for years, I've gotten to know a lot of people and we're friendly. But sometimes when you're in the public eye, it can get murky as to who's really my friend, who's going to come visit me in the hospital, who is going to come over to my house when my dog dies and drink cocoa with me. Who are those people? And it is sort of an exploration of, are we really friends or are we just people that are in the same business working at the same shoe factory known as show business, and we see each other when we check in and we see each other when we check out, and we're not really particularly close. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly what you mean. Are there people who are close friends who you've interviewed, like say Lisa Kudrow, who you've learned things from by actually doing something more formal like an interview rather than just having dinner together?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've known Lisa and I really got started in the business together as 22-year-olds just out of college, and we met at an improv class. We both had odd jobs, and we used to meet at a Dupar's coffee shop, and I would talk about, well, someday I'll have a show, and you'll be famous, and you'll be on my show as a guest. I mean, the kind of crazy talk that lots of people who are deluded have when they're 22, only in our case it turned out to actually happen. So it'd be hard-pressed for me to learn anything new from Lisa when I had her on the interview, but there are plenty of people who I've known over the years, and you start to talk to them. Like I had a conversation with Stephen Colbert, and I didn't intend for it to go this way, but we really did start to talk about anxiety and how we were both anxious Catholic kids and how we had sort of a punitive inner voice and this sort of emotional number we each did on ourselves. And it went into Stephen talking a lot about his pain. And we came out of there, of the interview, and I think I'd connected with him in this way that I had never thought I could. And I have to say, it's just a labor of love, the podcasts. I just thoroughly enjoy it, and it allows me at my age, after having been in, I started when I was 22, I'm 56 now, and I'm having more fun at this stage in my career than I've ever had before, and I don't think many people get to say that.
You're kind of shaking things up in your life. I mean, you've changed your hour TBS TV show into a half hour, and you're doing all these new podcast ventures, and doing stand-up comedy, and now you have this series of performances at clubs around the country. So what's going on in your life that made you want to make all these changes?
I'm having a nervous breakdown.
I knew it. And, I knew if I asked you, you would tell me that. Thank you.
Yeah.
I ask the questions that get the deep answers.
Yes, yes. It's the Larry King method. Larry King famously said once, I don't prepare for interviews. I just ask whatever pops into my head. That's my technique. And I said, that's not a technique. That's just called not preparing, Larry. That's my technique, is I just get up and I eat a giant ham sandwich and then I go in and I say whatever happens. And then that's my magic. I decided a little while ago, I've loved my career. I've been very lucky, you know, and I'm very lucky in my personal life. I married the right person. I have great kids. So at a certain point, you say, why not? There's so much fear and intensity in my teens, 20s, 30s, into the 40s. It was so much intensity and iron will, and I will work really hard, and I must, this has to be fantastic, and this has to be great, and this needs to be better, that I think something happens. A doctor would say, oh yeah, your testosterone's dropping, you're getting older. They would have some chemical reason, and it might be right. I don't think I ever had a lot of testosterone, and what I've had has probably been cut in half. I'm now, I think genetically now, I'm a Belgian woman, but I often get people stopping me on the street and saying, you are a very attractive woman, clearly from the Netherlands, and you're very tall. And I thank them, and we meet for coffee, and then I move on. But I guess I got to a phase where I thought, what I don't want to do is sleepwalk my way through my career at this stage. I think it'd be very easy to, okay, I got this down, I can do this for a bunch of years, and then sort of fade off into the sunlight. Or there's another way to go, which is scare yourself. And rather than be intimidated and afraid, as a lot of middle-aged people are, by everything that's changing, choose to be excited by it.
So are there jokes that you feel like you can't tell anymore in this era of heightened feminist awareness and the Me Too movement? Like, one of the things you always used to do is like your Bob Hope growl at attractive women. I mean, you wouldn't really. Yeah.
No, you know what?
You'd massage your nipples.
I didn't let go of
part of the joke. Can you do that anymore?
Yes. Well, first of all, I always molested myself.
Yes.
Which I think
okay.
we're still allowed
yes.
to do. The other thing is the growl when women would come on. It was this cartoony Bob Hope thing, like, and I don't know if anybody has ever seen it as sexual, because I don't know that I come across as them being really bluntly honest, as that sexual. And so I don't know that I do the growl as much anymore, but I find that the response is usually women laughing at me because it is such a caricature of a cartoonish, non-sexual person attempting, you know, this crazy, what is sort of 1950s or 1940s tiger growl. I don't know that anyone takes it seriously, nor should they. But
No, agreed.
I'd hate to
agreed.
Lose it completely.
Right, right. I remember when I was a guest on your late night show on NBC back in, I think, like 2004, when the show was over, I was like the last guest, and when the show was over and you were leaving the set, and you were very generous with your time. You spent a few minutes talking with me, and I introduced my husband to you. He's a big fan. And you said, you said, well, now that the show is over, I can go back to being depressed. And it was really funny. But at the same time, I thought, I bet yeah. there's some truth to that, too, that once you leave the stage, like, depression takes over.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Everyone has a different... I used to think, I'm not depressed, I'm just anxious. And I didn't understand, but I've always been... I was anxious as a little kid. I think I started having real bouts of strong anxiety around in fourth grade. I remembered fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, I mean, through high school. And I was... just had a lot of anxiety in the night and getting up a lot and not understanding what it was. And so I remember there was a period of my life in my 40s when people were saying, you know, maybe you're depressed. And I would be irritated. I would say, I'm not depressed. I have anxiety, but I'm not depressed. And then, of course, when I finally went and got some help, you know, at this sort of big chaotic time in my life, one of the first things that the doctor said to me was, I said, I'm not depressed. I just have anxiety. And they said, you know, yeah, anxiety is a chronic anxiety is a it's a subset or form of depression. It's a mode, you know. And so I think because I was able to function so well, I can always work. I can always get up and do what has to be done. And I just thought, well, I'm not depressed. And I had read accounts of people with real depression who can't get out of bed. And I said, that's never been me. And so I'm not that. So I don't have depression. But I realized that anxiety is a form. It's certainly something that can get in the way of your life. And yeah, I did go down. It's sort of a classic trope, but I think there's a lot of truth to it, which is when you're a performer, when you're on stage, there's no thinking. You just have to act. There's no time to think. You just do. And so for that time that you're in front of people, in a weird, crazy way, you'd think that the anxiety would be at its peak, and it's not. Everything goes away because there's no time. And it's very liberating, and it's really freeing. The problem is when it's over and you need to negotiate, then you have to start thinking again about, well, what's tomorrow and what are we going to do? And then it's all back in your brain, and that's where the problems start. So when I say it's time to be depressed again after a show, it's much better now. I mean, now I go home and I see my wife and kids and deal with whatever they're dealing with, and so it's different. You know, it's not the way it used to be. I used to go home and brood about what am I going to do next and what's tomorrow and how was that show? And if it was a good show, can we replicate it tomorrow? If it was a bad show, oh my God, how are we going to make up for that? What will people think? There's less of that now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think some of that is just kind of getting older and just having more perspective?
Definitely. I definitely think... I think getting old gets a bad rap.
Well, you're not old. You're older
so far
than you were.
Well, I'm older than I was, but it's all relative. If you asked a 19-year-old YouTuber, they would probably say, Conan O'Brien, didn't he fight in the Civil War? I'm probably the oldest person they can imagine. But I have found when people get rhapsodic about their childhood and say, ah, my boyhood, nothing will ever be as good as that, I don't understand what they're talking about, because I found youth to be very scary and intimidating, and I put a lot of pressure on myself. And
wait, let me stop you right there. What did you find really scary about childhood? What scared you the most? Or made you most anxious?
Well, my father would dress as a clown and hide under the bed and surprise me.
and that scared you?
He's a very sick man, and he does it to this day, although he's slower getting out from under the bed. It takes him about 40 minutes. No, I would say, as I said, I was really anxious, and I didn't know how I fit into the world. And I was not a good athlete, so I'd get picked last. I had a strange name. I think it took me a while for people to warm up to me. I was not someone who instantly showed up and everyone was like, "Hey, look at this Conan!" You know, high five. You know, I didn't click with people right away and know where I fit in the world. So yeah, childhood was not. It wasn't bad. It wasn't traumatic. It was just. I find that as I get older, my perspective has changed, and I can sort of see the importance of the real things and the unimportance of the silly things.
So maybe I'm making too much of this, but your father was an infectious disease specialist at Women and Brigham's Hospital.
Yeah. And still is.
Still is,
actually.
Does he still teach at Harvard?
Yeah.
Does he still teach Robert too?
Yeah, he does. I don't think he's not teaching right now, but he's working on a grant application.
Okay.
Now as we speak, because his specialty is microbiology and antibiotic resistance, and he's every year looking for more grant money.
Oh,
and
God,
my
good
father
luck.
Did fight in the Civil War, so yeah, he's been around a while. He's doing a good job.
So your father is an infectious disease expert, specialist, and your mother, until she retired, was a partner in a law firm. So growing up with that, it's in a way all about consequences, like germs that can kill you. And with your mother, like, if you do the wrong thing, I don't know what kind of law she practiced, but if you do the wrong thing, you can be sued. You can go to prison.
Yeah.
You know, so did you grow up with the sense that, like, everything has, like, life-changing consequences?
Well, I think I will simplify it for you. And that's sort of a very interesting psychological tact you just took with, like, my dad's work and my mom's work, and that deserves further exploration. But I can simplify it for you. My parents are very Catholic. And so, yes, you grow up with a very strong sense of consequences, you know, and also they, I grew up in, you look at my family, and there's an Irish immigrant, and it doesn't matter where you're from, every generation is trying to better their circumstances from the previous generation. So my people come over from Ireland, they work in the mills in central, you know, Massachusetts. Then, you know, if you can get out of working in the mills, you're doing what my grandfathers did, which was you're either a traffic policeman in Worcester, Mass, or you work your way with no college education, as my other grandfather did, into being a teller at a bank, to being the person sort of organizing the bank, to being someone who's helping to run the bank. And then what do? Their kids get full scholarships and go to college and then go on to graduate school and become, you know, get a law degree and a medical degree. And so everyone's bettering the situation that they inherited and raising the bar for the next generation. And then, of course, I was a workaholic as a kid and very serious. People have a hard time reconciling that. I was not some just naturally brilliant guy. I had to work. I was not good at math and science, and I made myself. If I had to memorize textbooks, I would memorize them, because my goal was, I don't know what I'm going to do in this world, but I need to get into a good college. And I did. What do I do once I get to Harvard? I join the comedy magazine just as a lark, and the next thing you know, that's all I care about. So I think in my career, there's been a sense of, wait, generation after generation has been pushing the puzzle piece slowly forward, and I'm taking all of this and gambling it on being a professional goofball.
Right.
You know? And so, talk about consequences. You know, to my parents' credit, they really did imbue in all of us a really powerful moral code. And so we've had that since we were kids, too. And those can feel like big consequences.
You know, with self-punishment, I sometimes think there's a sense of, like, if you punish yourself and if you're penitent in some way, that it will avoid a harsher, externally given punishment. Like, I know I did wrong, I've punished myself, so you don't have to do anything, I've taken care of it. It's almost like, you know, preemptive punishment, but it could be, like, so damaging.
Well, the other way, just as you were describing that, it's where self-deprecating humor comes from. And that's my milieu, is self-deprecating humor. But I'll make fun of myself before Terry Gross can, because you're known to rip people apart.
I know,
the show.
I know.
Very cruel. You are the Rickles. You are the Rickles of the airwaves. But when I did my first late night show ever, all the press had been about, can he replace Letterman, and how can he, and Letterman's the best ever, and Letterman was wronged, and this is the idiot that NBC came up with to cover up their mistake, and it's the worst. And that was sort of the story. And I remember at the time, some people at NBC saying, just don't mention the Letterman thing when you go on the air. And I thought, well, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. So we wrote, I had an idea, and we wrote this cold opening, which was me waking up in the morning, and I turn on the TV, and it's two people from Entertainment Tonight, reporters saying, can Conan be as good as Letterman? This is the big day. Can he do it? And me smiling like an idiot, a grinning, confident idiot, and then marching down the street to Rockefeller Center, and everyone I encounter says, better be as good as Letterman. And every single, and it gets more and more absurd until a horse goes, better be as good as Letterman. And I'm smiling and smiling and smiling, and then I finally get to my dressing room, and I go in, and I'm whistling happily, getting ready to do the show, and I make a noose. I put my head in it, and just as I'm about to hang myself, there's a knock on the door, and they say, Conan, it's time. Now, the people at NBC were appalled. They were like, you can't do this. And I'm like, no, this is exactly what we have to do. We have to go right at it. And it turned out people to this day tell me that was the first time they ever saw me, and they really loved that. And that is very me, which is I'm going to mock myself before you can. And it's tricky because you can overdo it. And it's all, you know, it's preemptive. And it's exactly what you're saying, which is self-flagellation and punishing yourself is a way ultimately of being in control. Because if I hurt myself, then I've handled the punishment and no one else has to. And it can get, as we know, it can turn into an S&M fetish. And it can also, as we all know, but it can, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it's very much, it's all about control. And at the end of the day, so many of the problems in our life are us trying to assert control where we don't have a lot of control. Comedians are the ultimate control freak. So we're trying to control how you feel about us at any given moment. So yeah, on some level, a lot of, you know, humor is preemptive. It's, I will find this all ridiculous before you can find me ridiculous.
Your TBS show starts with this montage of you, of like Conan through the years, starting with you when you're a very young mm-hmm. child, and then being an older child, and then a teenager and an adult, and then having your own shows. So I wanted to spend a little more time in the young Conan years. You love music, and you play guitar, you sing, you don't try to pass yourself off as a professional musician, but you clearly love music.
Oh, God, no.
In the studio where you are, there was a guitar sitting there, and during the sound check, I heard you just playing around with it. Would you be willing to just play and sing something that you were so proud you learned when you were young, when you first picked up a guitar?
When I first picked up, this is when a comedian picks up a guitar, unless he's Steve Martin, it's time to go. It's time to get out. So you've been warned. There's a, I think, kind of out of tune guitar here. And I was just in a room. I come into this room and I'm messing around with the guitar when suddenly I realize you're here. And then you have a gotcha moment of, we can make him do this, but hold on. The only reason I play guitar is because when I was in college, I really got into the music of the early, early Sun Sessions of Elvis Presley. So the first thing I learned was Elvis's version of Blue Moon of Kentucky. And I'll just give you a second of it. But he played this, and it was a bit of a scandal at the time because this was not the way you were supposed to play Blue Moon of Kentucky. And this just makes me happy. So again, my apologies. Well, I said blue moon
blue moon, keep on, keep shining bright. Well, blue moon, keep on shining bright, gonna bring you back my baby tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright. I said blue moon, Hokitoki, won't you keep on shining? Shine on the one that's on the left me blue. I said blue moon, Hokitoki, won't you keep on shining? Shine on the one that's on the left me blue. Cause it was on a moonlit night, baby, stars shining bright. Wind blowing high, my head love said goodbye. Said blue moon, Hokitoki, won't you keep on shining? Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
Something like that.
Yeah, so I loved it. That was great. You really put yourself into that.
Why are you crying?
That was great. Conan O'Brien, it's been great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much. And good luck with all the new projects you have now.
Thank you. And you are one of my all-time favorite people to talk to. And you're really brilliant at this. And it's a joy. So thank you so much for having me on. This is free therapy. And I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. Conan O'Brien hosts Conan weekday nights at 11 on TBS. The second season of his podcast, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, starts Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.